Les colloques du Collège de France.
So, this is now Professor Martin O'Neill, Professor of Political Philosophy at the University of York, who works on a variety of questions, but mostly I think he's Mr. Socialism and Liberal Egalitarianism, and who is going to talk today about the climate emergency, state power, and the expansion of democratic control. So, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Leah, and thank you very much indeed for the invitation to be here as well. It's daunting to come and give a talk at so storied and significant a venue as this one. And you've piled the pressure further on with that introduction. What I want to do today is to talk a little bit about a very pressing issue that obviously that we're facing with regard to politics and with regard to how our societies are dealing with the challenge of climate change, and to suggest that the failure that we see in how our societies are managing to address that problem also connects with something of a failure in political philosophy to think a little bit beyond some of the inherited assumptions that we find ourselves with. So, this gives a quick outline of what I want to cover. I'm going to give you some empirical information, hopefully not too much, about what I take to be the inadequacy of the policy response to the climate emergency. I'm going to talk a little bit also about current developments in Chinese public policy and what that might tell us about the range of possibility that could be open to other countries as well. And then I'll talk a little bit about ideas of green economic planning. Before introducing, I've got a very unusual pair of suspects to discuss here. Alex Karp of Palantir, who some of you may have read about, and George Orwell, the British democratic socialist. And I'll try and say a little bit about the different alternatives that they might suggest to us for ways forward from our current conjunction. And then I'll talk, a little bit about why political philosophy needs to turn more seriously towards issues of collective control of investment and ideas around economic planning. So, my claim is that the failure to deal adequately with the climate emergency, it shows a problem with democratic politics, but also a related problem in political philosophy. So when confronting the problem of climate change, political philosophers need to, I think, reconsider aspects of the dominant liberal paradigm of justice and to identify the shortcomings, failures, or oversights of that tradition. Now, my argument today, it really emerges from within the liberal egalitarian tradition. So going back to Jan's talk this morning, this is very much one where the values that are at stake are those that I think are broadly shared between liberals and socialists. But nevertheless, I think from quite an uncontroversial or shared starting point, we can think about ways in which we need to move beyond some of the assumptions of recent liberal egalitarian thinking, and especially the assumption of market primacy. But let me start with some, as I say, some empirical issues about the challenges we face with regard to climate change and energy policy. Now, this graph on the right should be extraordinarily optimistic and cheering. It's a graph that shows the fall in cost of renewable energy. It's a logarithmic scale. So as you can see, the cost of producing green energy has been falling extremely, extremely rapidly, especially over the last decade or so. Nevertheless, the progress that's being made towards the kinds of changes that we would need to get to a world of net zero emissions by 2050, so the kind of agreed upon target if we were to try to keep climate change within reasonable bounds, is being very significantly missed. So there's progress over the last 15 years or so. There's where we'd need to be to by 2030 to be on track for net zero by 2050. And as you can see, there is a significant failure to meet that kind of standard. So there's a wonderfully informative, although not very cheering or optimistic website, the Climate Action Tracker report shows what we're on course for at the moment. So the Paris Agreement goal of 1.5 degrees of global warming is something that it looks like we've really sort of overshot. An optimistic scenario now is talking about a band between about 1.5 to 2.4 degrees of global warming by the end of this century. But actually, if you look at on the basis of agreed upon international actions that are currently in place, we're looking more like a band between 2.1 degrees and 3.3 degrees of warming, with a sort of central case that's a full degree higher than the Paris target. So it's not really a very optimistic projection of where we're at. Now, why should that be? How could it be that the price of renewable energy is falling so quickly, and yet the kind of action that's needed in order to meet climate targets doesn't seem to be happening? So I think a very revealing book on this was Brett Christopher's book, The Price is Wrong, which came out in 2024 from Verso. He points out that really price is only part of the story. What matters when you think about decisions that are made about investment in renewable energy is profitability. And profitability can decline in renewable energy even if the levelized cost of energy production from renewable sources is dropping, because renewable energy sources, wind and solar, have very high upfront costs. There's lack of long-run predictability in terms of what returns are going to look like as maybe prices drop further over time from renewable sources. And there's generally a need for debt finance rather than the kind of funding from retained profits that you get from the large petrochemical companies. So what one has is a situation in which actually the kind of ongoing falls in price just make it harder for capitalist investors to kind of turn to the renewable sector and say, oh yeah, look, this is definitely investable. This is something that we can think of as something that's going to reliably deliver profits for us into the future. And if you think about the need for sort of large-scale structural investments in future energy production to be mediated through capitalist mechanisms, through the decision-making of those whose responsibility to their shareholders is to generate profit, you see very quickly how this kind of structural problem could emerge. So I think one way of making this very vivid, really, is to kind of think of a distinction there between energy as a public utility and energy as a site of profit. Now imagine two futures. Well, imagine a future trajectory where you were told that actually abundant, incredibly cheap renewable energy was going to be something that it was very, very easy to produce within the next 30 or 40 years. Now, if you're thinking about that from the point of view of a citizen, that would be brilliant, amazing, very, very welcome news, right? If we knew that we had an abundant supply of very cheap energy coming in the future. If you think of that from the perspective of someone making investment decisions oriented towards profitability as a private market actor, that's actually quite a worrying thing to hear, right? That makes it less investable to think about how you're going to allocate capital towards potential future investments in the energy sector. So the interests that we have as citizens and the interests that capitalist investors might have just completely come apart there. And you can have a situation where you get what looks like this very encouraging, very rapid drop in the costs of renewable energy, and at the same time, a situation where capitalist processes of investment aren't going to perhaps deliver the kinds of changes that we need. And so what we have, I think, in most parts of the world is that there has not been the degree of shift of investment towards renewable energy that we'd need if we were to really be serious about meeting the kinds of climate targets that political actors have set for themselves. The real exception here, interestingly, is China. So China added around 350 gigawatts of renewable capacity in 2023, and then 585 gigawatts in 2024. Now, if you're someone like me with more of a humanities background, I won't pretend that I've got a very intuitive idea of exactly how big a gigawatt is. But I think the way of thinking about this that makes it really, really vivid is that if you take the year 2024, the last year for which I could get full figures, fully two-thirds of all the renewable capacity that came online in the world was all in one country, right? It was all in China, which you see from that graph there. So if you look at all of, there's France, there's Germany, Australia, the US. If you look at places that are making, some degree of investment in bringing renewable energy online, this is all completely dwarfed relative to the kinds of changes that one sees in China. So the economic historian and commentator Adam Tooze, I've got a couple of quotations there from Tooze that I think make this point quite vividly. China, he says, is the first large economy in which clean energy investment has become the principal driving force of overall investment and economic growth. And then more recently, he says, the spectacular acceleration in global renewable investment is in fact a story about one country, China. And I'm sure this is the case in France as well. We recently put solar panels on our house in Yorkshire, and of course all the components are Chinese made. So even where renewable capacity is coming online in other places, the story often is about Chinese investment and innovation that stands behind that. Now, why is that potentially significant? Well, for lots of reasons, but for one reason, when one thinks about the kinds of limits of existing models of how we might expect liberal societies to behave, the really interesting thing is what the Chinese state has done to make this possible. So why has China been able to be a kind of globally exceptional player in this area? So there's much greater central coordination of policy with government influence on the behaviour of energy firms. There's been a lot of government intervention in making land available for wind and solar, and in kind of facilitating the integration of that into the energy system. Now, it's not like all of this new capacity is being done directly by the state. It isn't. It's often being done by private companies. But what the Chinese state has done is kind of change the conditions under which those companies are operating. So very significantly, there's a state provision of a 20-year energy price guarantee for renewable power. So if you're an investor in China, you've got a lot more confidence about making large investments in the renewable sector. And very significantly as well is the role of the central bank. So there's the Carbon Emissions Reduction Facility, by which the Chinese Central Bank has provided guarantees to stand behind loans from more specific private banks that are going towards investment in the renewable sector. So overall, you can see this as a form of green economic planning, right? So the Chinese state has decided very seriously to kind of massively increase the amount of renewable energy that's going to come online. And it's done lots of things in the planning system, in the regulation of private companies, through monetary policy and the behavior of the central bank. Through a range of different levers, it's created the conditions under which that could happen. So this brings me to my to something where there might at least be some philosophical content and not just some graphs about energy production, given that this is, after all, a political philosophy conference. And here is an extremely basic but I think, hopefully appealing set of thoughts. The basic argument is this. If there's a policy goal that's significantly urgent and significant, sufficiently urgent and significant, there's no reason in principle that democratic states shouldn't also intervene in the economy that overcomes that kind of profitability problem that Brett Christopher's identifies in his book, right? If there's a logjam caused by the difficulty of private actors in making decisions about investability in the renewable sector, but we have an urgent shared need to make sure that more renewable energy comes online, then there's every reason for democratic governments to intervene within energy markets, to use whatever levers they have to make that kind of outcome come about. So put more strongly, if democratic states fail to use their full set of powers to respond to the climate emergency, they're betraying their responsibilities of justice both to current and to future generations. And they're failing to put the holistic interests of democratic citizens ahead of a commitment to market mechanisms, right? If you're not just going to wait for private investors to make this happen, then there's every reason to bring about outcomes that are going to bring online this kind of step change with regard to renewable energy capacity. In doing that, it's appropriate for states to use a full set of levers, not limited to market-shaping measures, but including deployment of central bank financing, the use of monetary policy, anything else that they might choose to do. So there ought to be an analogy here to disaster response, so if you think about COVID, or to wartime planning, which is the case I want to talk a bit more about. If conditions are urgent, then using the full set of democratic powers that states have would seem entirely appropriate. If the state limits its actions to those that will allow private capital to make profits from the energy transition, then on the one hand, that's an irrational failure to use the full panoply of state power. B, it creates an outcome that will likely increase inequality rather than address it, right? If you're having to make sure that any desirable outcome has to be one that there's sufficiently attractive profits to be made on, then that's going to generate certain kinds of inequality. And C, it needlessly deprives the state of a possible future source of revenue. So if you think about democratic states deciding, for example, if they're going to bring on a lot more just directly to invest to bring a lot more renewable capacity, then actually that could be something that's also beneficial with regard to the kind of long-run economic position of those countries. So here are my unlikely couple, Alex Karp and George Orwell. My background suggestion here is that our current situation, thinking that actually changes have to go via the investment decisions of capitalist investors, could be attacked from two different sides. There's a kind of socialist alternative that I'll talk more about, but there's also the view of Alex Karp. And I think it's really important to realise that we seem to be at a moment where the choices aren't between sort of business as usual. It's no longer neoliberal capitalism versus something kind of softer and more human. But there's also many worse options on the table as well. So Karp, the head of Palantir, has a really interesting critique that has something in common, actually, with the Brett Christopher's kind of critique of neoliberal capitalism, which he then uses through a kind of grotesque non sequitur to arrive at an argument for something that's much worse than neoliberal capitalism. So here's Karp. For decades, he said, we have taken this focus, and indeed obsession in many cases, by the technology industry on consumer culture for granted, hardly questioning the direction, and we think misdirection of capital and talent to the trivial and the ephemeral. The instinct by Silicon Valley to steer away from the most important problems we face as a society towards what are essentially the minor and trivial yet solvable inconveniences of everyday consumer life, from online shopping to food delivery. So what Karp is saying is, if profitability is criterial for what gets invested in, you get what we have at the moment. You get all this investment in trivialities, you get a misdirection of human creativity, work and energy towards things that don't serve the common good. So far, I think you know, someone that was worried about some of the bad features of neoliberal capitalism could agree with that. I think Karp's diagnosis, if you go that far, seems quite plausible. Profit-driven investment systematically misdirects capital and talent away from socially urgent goals. But his conclusion then is simply horrifying. He goes from that diagnosis to affirming that what we need instead, if we care about the common good, is a much closer alignment between investment, the work of tech companies, and then the security and the military. So what you get on Karp's view is that actually we need to redirect all of this kind of human creative potential, all of this investment towards things that will work for the military or for the ICE anti-immigration force in the US, or indeed, you know, he's been a very active supporter of the IDF. But I think it's just important to think that those who, like Karp, who point towards the problem of everything being rooted via profitability, that, as it were, the kind of cutting edge of like the American tech elite, they're not anymore defending neoliberal capitalism of the kind that's been familiar. They're defending a kind of grotesque merger of the security state with the tech industry and with the kind of the main sort of paths of investment in new technology and in sort of the future direction of the economy. And I think it's worth taking seriously their diagnosis whilst obviously rejecting their conclusions. Which brings us to Orwell. So Orwell, I think, gives us a very interesting way of thinking about state capacity and about the things that democratic states could choose to do at times of emergency. Now, in Britain, everyone at school reads Animal Farm and 1984, which obviously is a very important book for those interested in the ways that the attempts by the state to become more central to people's lives could go wrong. But the essay I want to talk about by Orwell is his 1941 essay, The Lion and the Unicorn. So this is making a case for a certain kind of democratic socialism, and it's making the case at a time of emergency. So it's written during the Blitz. A large part of the essay is an exercise in a certain kind of an argument for a certain kind of patriotic British exceptionalism that would be of zero interest to a French audience. But it gets interesting in its final section, where he talks about really about state capacity and about what a socialist response to emergency conditions might look like. And I want to talk about two significant claims that Orwell makes in that essay. So the first of those, that in times when urgent collective action is needed, it's intolerable to have to placate private capitalist interests as a precondition for dealing with that emergency. So he's making exactly that kind of case in the context of 1941. In England. Secondly, when a large collective endeavour requires shared sacrifice, the disproportionate control of resources by the rich becomes both normatively unacceptable and practically unsustainable. It stops you doing the things that you need to do, right? And also, right, it generates inequalities that become to seem completely unacceptable when we're at a point where there's maybe a need for shared sacrifice. So here's some of what Orwell has to say in that 1941 text about what needs to happen when a democratic society faces an emergency situation. So famously, he says, you need to think more about collective democratic control over investment. He famously says there, we cannot win the war without introducing socialism, nor establish socialism without winning the war. And that has egalitarian implications, both in terms of distribution and in terms of what we might call productive justice, and an issue that really relates to some of what's been discussed earlier here today about burden sharing. So Orwell says that there's a need to eliminate the class of mere owners who live not by virtue of anything they produce, but by title deeds and share certificates. Under difficult times, one simply can't, as a society, afford the rich of that kind. And state ownership implies, therefore, he says, that nobody shall live without working. The thought that actually something like a labour requirement might be an implication of justice under those sorts of conditions. So my hypothesis, the thing that I want to throw out for consideration today, is that the climate emergency puts us in a structurally very similar situation to the one that Orwell was talking about in 1941, and hence a similar kind of response may well be justifiable. So, bringing it back now more fully into the realm of political philosophy, why have ideas about the collective democratic control over investment been so off the table in political philosophy, especially in liberal egalitarian political philosophy? Especially given, as I've suggested, I've not appealed to anything that Jan Candiali might describe, I think, as a distinctively socialist value here. I think in terms of the normative foundations of the case for saying that there's an urgent need to transform our energy policy, to transform the pattern of investment that we see in our societies, that's something we've all got reason to want to happen. Why is it so difficult to think about the mechanisms that might make that happen? And why is that difficult even for political philosophers and not just in terms of practical politics? So I think at least since John Rawls, liberal political philosophers have seen their task as primarily being about developing and elaborating accounts of justice for a market economy. Even when Rawls talks about ideas of liberal socialism, where there's more collective ownership of the means of production, he really is still thinking about a market economy where consumer preferences are going to drive investment decisions, where basically the profitability problem doesn't get solved because we still think about decisions made in the market driving decisions over production over time, rather than there being collective democratic deliberation about what the future direction of investment should be. I think if one were putting on a historian's hat there, one would say that there's something about the Cold War context of the development of these sorts of ideas from the 1950s through to the 1980s. That there was something about the particular kind of political context in the US, maybe in the whole Anglophone philosophical world, that actually led people to baking in a set of assumptions that they didn't need to bake into their thinking. So as I said, when Rawls talks about socioeconomic regimes, he counterposes market economies as being essentially contrasted to what he calls forms of command economy with a general economic plan, right? So Rawls says to his readers, well, look, whether you're more capitalist or more socialist, the centrality of the market is something we all agree on. The primacy of the market is something we should all agree on, because the alternative to that is something like a kind of general plan that he associates with kind of Stalin's five-year plans, which are completely inimical to the kinds of values of freedom or equality that might stand behind an account of justice. So on his view, any idea of a general economic plan raises the prospect of an unjust society with limited individual rights and freedoms, a lack of freedom of occupational choice, and so on, something that immediately falls at every hurdle in terms of thinking about justice. But I think if one considers the way in which green economic planning could be done, consistent perhaps with the kinds of planning that needed to be done in order to face the emergency of 1941, the kinds of things that Orwell was talking about, that is not about having a comprehensive or totalizing form of economic planning. In fact, The very Orwell that a few years later is writing 1984 about the danger of a comprehensively planned economy is the same writer who sees the potential for democratic socialism, nevertheless, to significantly reduce inequality and to have a high degree of directed economic planning, but without that kind of totalizing, fully comprehensive form of planning. There's no contradiction between sort of those two faces of Orwell's thinking. And so you could have much greater democratic direction of investment decisions without falling into the zone of Rawls's worries about forms of command economy that would be unavoidably unjust. Green economic planning in a more limited form doesn't threaten, need not threaten, individual freedoms, such as freedom of occupational choice. Rather than being authoritarian, it can actually be seen as the expression of a commitment to democracy against the limitations of market mechanisms. Surely it's less authoritarian, it's more democratic, it's more in keeping with principles of justice to have more of our decisions about investment made through collective democratic deliberation, rather than the future development of the economy and of the societies in which we live being driven by the particular choices about profitable investment made by groups of capitalist investors. So my very minimal claim at the end here is that we need to return to a set of thinkers whose work has, I think, been largely occluded, who wrote about ways in which economic planning could be consistent with an open democratic society. So people like James Mead, Stuart Holland, but especially Barbara Wootton, author of this wonderful book that no one reads anymore, but which I would urge everyone to look at, Freedom Under Planning, which actually talked about the ways in which a certain degree of strategic economic planning could enhance the options and the freedom of individual citizens, rather than thinking about a kind of crude binary between a free or a planned economy. So, currently, liberal egalitarianism is operating with much too small a space of institutional possibility. We're closing off options that should be open to us, and we're making unthinking assumptions that are constraining the range of our thinking, and I think that's something that we ought to change. So, I'll stop there. Thank you for listening.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.